a series of M60s, energy pistols, combat knives, and other gear. Anything and everything, except what he needed most. Then, just when he had nearly given up hope, he saw a few inches of olive-drab tubing protruding from under a dead combat form. He rolled the Exolite over and felt a rising sense of excitement. Was the launcher loaded? If so, he was in luck. A quick check revealed that the weapon was loaded. And as if to prove that luck comes in threes, the Spartan found two reloads only a few meters away. Armed with a launcher, he was ready to go to work. The Wraith represented the most significant threat, so he decided to deal with that first. It took time to make his way back across the face of the pyramid to a point where he could get a clear shot, but he did. The monster was dangerously close as he put a pair of rockets into the mortar tank and watched it explode. He ejected the spent rocket tubes, slammed a reload home, and shifted his aim. Two more rockets lanced ahead and detonated in clusters of Covenant soldiers. He fell back and slung the rocket launcher. He had a limited supply of rockets, and once they were gone, he had no choice but to go down onto the valley floor and finish the job the hard way. He crept up on the pair of elites who stood guard near a banshee. They went down from deadly, spine-cracking blows, and he stepped past their fallen corpses. He examined the banshee's controls while Cortana pulled up files the tech boys and intel had prepared based on examinations of captured craft. He boarded the single-seat aircraft and activated its power plant. He wondered why the aliens hadn't used the ship against him, was thankful that they hadn't, and eyed the instrument panel. The Master Chief had never flown one of the attack ships before, but was qualified to fly most of the UNSC's atmospheric and space-going ships, so between his own experience and the tech files Cortana provided, he found the controls relatively easy to understand. The takeoff was a bit wobbly, but it wasn't long before the flight began to smooth out and the Banshee started to climb. It was dark, and snow continued to fall, which meant that visibility was poor. He kept a close eye on both the nav point Cortana had projected onto his HUD and the instrument panel. The design was different, but an alien turn-and-bank indicator still looked like what it was and helped the human maintain his orientation. The attack ship made good speed, and the valleys were quite close together, so it wasn't long before the Spartan spotted the well-lit platform which jutted out from the face of the cliff, as well as the enemy fire which lashed up to greet him. The word was out, it seemed, and the Covenant didn't want any visitors. Rather than put down under fire, he decided to carry out a couple of strafing runs first. He swooped low and used the Banshee's plasma and fuel rod cannons to sweep the platform clear of sentries before decelerating for what he hoped would be an unopposed landing. The Banshee crunched into the platform, bounced once, then ground to a halt. The Chief dismounted, passed through a hatch, and entered the tunnel beyond.
"We need to interrupt the pulse generator's energy stream," Cortana informed him. "I have adjusted your shield system so that it will deliver an EMP burst and disrupt the generator, but you'll have to walk into the beam to trigger it."
The Master Chief paused just shy of the next hatch. "I'll have to do what?"
"You'll have to walk into the beam to trigger it," the AI repeated matter-of-factly. "The EMP blast should neutralize the generator."
"Should?" the Chief demanded. "Whose side are you on?"
"Yours," Cortana replied firmly. "We're in this together, remember?"
"Yeah, I remember," the Spartan growled. "But you're not the one with the bruises." The AI chose to remain silent as the Chief passed through a hatch, paused to see if anyone would attempt to cancel his ticket, and followed the nav indicator to the chamber located at the center of the room. Once he was there, the pulse generator was impossible to miss. It was so intensely white that his visor automatically darkened in order to protect his eyes. Not only that, but the Chief could feel the air crackle around him as he approached the delta-shaped guide structures and prepared to step in between them.
"I have to walk into that thing?" the Chief inquired doubtfully. "Isn't there some easier way to commit suicide?"
"You'll be fine," Cortana replied soothingly. "I'm almost sure of it."
The Spartan took note of the almost, clenched his teeth, and pushed himself into the blindingly intense light. The response was nearly instantaneous. There was something akin to an explosion,
The lights started to pulsate, and the floor shook in response. The chief hurried to disengage, felt a bit of suction, but managed to pull free. As he did so, he noticed that his shields had been drained. His skin felt sunburned.
"The pulse generator's central core is offline," Cortana said. "Well done."
Another squadron of sentinels arrived. They swooped into the cramped pulse generator chamber like vultures, fanned out, and seared the area with ruby-red energy beams. Not only did the monitor take exception to the damage, he was after the index, too. But the chief knew how to deal with the mechanical killers, and proceeded to dodge their lasers as he destroyed one after another. Finally, the air thick with the stench of ozone, he was free to withdraw. He went back through the same tunnel to the platform where the Banshee waited.
"The second pulse generator is located in an adjacent canyon," Cortana announced easily. "Move out, and I'll mark the nav point when we get closer."
The Master Chief sent the Banshee into a wide bank and toward the next objective. Minus the refrigeration required to preserve them, the bodies laid out on the metal tables had already started to decay, and the stench forced Silva to breathe through his mouth as he entered the makeshift morgue and waited for McKay to begin her presentation. Six heavily armed hell jumpers were lined up along one wall, ready to respond if one or more of the Flood suddenly came back to life. It seemed unlikely, given the level of damage each corpse had sustained, but the creatures had proven themselves to be extremely resilient and had an alarming tendency to reanimate. McKay, who was still trying to deal with the fact that more than 15 Marines under her command had lost their lives in a single battle, looked pale. Silva understood, even sympathized, but couldn't allow that to show. There was simply no time for grief, self-doubt, or guilt. The company commander would have to do what he did, which was to suck it up and keep on going. He nodded coolly.
"Lieutenant?"
McKay swallowed in an attempt to counter the nausea she felt.
"Sir! Yes, sir!"
"Obviously, there's still a great deal we don't know, but based on our observations during the fight and information obtained from Covenant POWs, here's the best intelligence we have. It seems that the Covenant came here searching for holy relics. We think that means useful technology, and ran into a life form they refer to as the Flood." She gestured at the fallen creatures on the slab.
"Those are Flood."
"Charming," Silva muttered.
"As best we can figure out," McKay said, "the Flood is a parasitic life form which attacks sentient beings, erases their minds, and takes control of their bodies. Wellesley believes that Halo is constructed to house them, to keep them under control, but we have no direct evidence to support that. Perhaps Cortana or the Chief can confirm our findings when we're able to make contact with them again. The Flood manifests in various forms, starting with these things," McKay said, using her combat knife to prod a flaccid infection form. "As you can see, it has tentacles in place of legs, plus a couple of extremely sharp penetrators, which they use to invade the victim's central nervous system and take control of it. Eventually, they work their way inside the host body and take up residence there."
Silva tried to imagine what that might feel like and felt a shiver run down his spine. Outwardly, he was unchanged.
"Please continue,"
McKay said.
"Yes, sir,"
and moved to the next table.
"This is what the Covenant call a combat form. As you can see from what remains of its face, this one was human. We think she was a Navy weapons tech, based on the tattoos still visible on her skin. If you peek through the hole in her chest, you can see the remains of the infection form that deflated itself enough to fit in around her heart and lungs."
Silva didn't want to look, but felt he had to, and moved close enough to see the wrinkled scalp, to which a few isolated clumps of filthy hair still clung. His eyes catalogued a parade of horrors. The sickly-looking skin, the alarmingly blue eyes which still bulged, as if in response to some unimaginable pain, the twisted, toothless mouth, the slightly puckered 7.62-millimeter bullet hole through the right cheekbone, the lumpy, penetrator-filled neck, the bony chest, now split down the middle so that the woman's flat breasts hung down to either side, the grossly distorted torso, punctured by three overlapping bullet wounds, the thin, sinewy arms, and the strangely graceful fingers, one of which still bore a silver ring. The major didn't say anything, but his face must have telegraphed what he felt, because McKay nodded.
"It's pretty awful, isn't it, sir? I've seen death before, sir."
She swallowed and shook her head.
"But nothing like this."
"For what it's worth, Covenant victims don't look any better. This individual was armed with a pistol, her own probably, but the Floods seem to pick up and use any weapon they can lay their hands on. Not only that, but they pack a very nasty punch, which can be lethal. Most combat forms appear to be derived from humans and elites," McKay continued, as she moved to the last table. "We suspect that grunts and jackals are deemed too small for first-class combat material, and are therefore used as a sort of nucleus around which carrier forms can grow. It's hard to tell by looking at the puddle of crap on the table in front of you, but at one time this thing contained four of the infection forms you saw earlier, and when it popped, the resulting explosion had enough force to knock Sergeant Lister on his can." That, or the mental picture that it conveyed, was sufficient to elicit nervous grins from the helljumpers who lined the back wall. Apparently they liked the idea of something that could put Lister on his ass. Silva frowned. "Does Wellesley have scans of this stuff?"
"Yes, sir."
"Excellent. Nice job. Have the bodies burned, send these troops up for some fresh air, and report to my office in an hour." McKay nodded.
"Yes, sir."
Zuka Zamami lay belly down on the hard-packed dirt and used his monocular to scan the Pillar of Autumn. It wasn't heavily guarded.
The Covenant was stretched too thin for that, but the Council had reinforced the security force subsequent to the human raid, and evidence of that was visible in the banshees, ghosts, and wraiths that patrolled the area around the downed ship. Yayup, who lay next to the elite, had no such device and was forced to rely on his own vision.
"This plan is insane," Zamami said out of the side of his mouth. "I should have killed you a long time ago."
"Yes, Excellency,"
the grunt agreed patiently, knowing that the talk was just that. The truth was that the officer was afraid to return to the Truth and Reconciliation, and now had very little choice but to accept Yayup's plan, especially in light of the fact that he had been unable to come up with one of his own.
"Give it to me one more time," the elite demanded, "so I'll know that you won't make any mistakes."
Yayup eyed the readout on his wrist. He had two, maybe 2.5 units of methane left, before his tanks were empty and he would suffocate, a problem which didn't seem to trouble the elite at all.
It was tempting to pull his pistol, shoot Zamami in the head, and implement the strategy on his own, but there were advantages to being in company with a warrior, plus a giddy sense of power that went with having threatened the warrior and survived.
With that in mind, Yayup managed to suppress both his panic and a rising sense of resentment.
"Of course, Excellency. As you know, simple plans are often best, which is why there is a good chance this one will work. On the possibility that the Council of Masters is actively looking for Zuka Zamami, you will choose one of the commandos who died on the human encampment and assume that individual's identity.
Then, with me at your side, we will report to the officer in charge of guarding the alien ship, explain that we were taken prisoner in the aftermath of the raid, but were subsequently able to escape."
"But what then?"
the elite inquired warily.
"What if he submits my DNA for a match?"
"Why would he do that?" the grunt countered patiently. "He's short-handed, and here, as if presented by the Great Ones themselves, is a commando elite. Would you run the risk of having such a find reassigned? No, I think not. Under circumstances such as these, you would seize the opportunity to add such a highly capable warrior to your command, and give thanks for the blessing."
It sounded good, especially the highly capable warrior part, so Zamami agreed.
"Fine. What about later?"
"Later, if there is a later," Yayup said wearily, "we will have to come up with another plan. In the meantime, this initiative will assure us of food, water, and methane."
"All right," Zamami said. "Let's jump on the Banshee and make our appearance."
"Are you sure that's the best idea?"
the grunt inquired tactfully.
"If we arrive on a Banshee, the commanding officer might wonder why we were so slow to check in."
The elite eyed what looked like a long, hard walk, sighed, and acquiesced.
Agreed.
A hint of his former arrogance resurfaced.
But you will carry my gear.
Of course,
Yayup said, scrambling to his feet.
Was there ever any doubt?
The inmate had attempted suicide twice, which was why the interior of his cell was bare, and under round-the-clock surveillance. The creature that had once been Private Wallace A. Jenkins sat on the floor with both wrists chained to an eyebolt located just over his head. The Flood mind, which the human continued to think of as the Other, had been quiet for a while, but was present nonetheless, and glowered in what amounted to a cognitive corner, angry, but weak. Hinges squealed as the metal door swung open. Jenkins turned to look and saw a male non-com enter the room, followed by a female officer. The private felt an almost overwhelming sense of shame, and did what he could to turn away. Earlier, before the guard secured his wrists to the wall, Jenkins had used pantomime to request a mirror. A well-meaning corporal brought one in, held it up in front of the soldier's devastated face, and was frightened when he tried to scream. The initial suicide attempt followed 30 minutes later. McKay took a look at the prisoner's dry, parched lips and guessed that he might be thirsty. She called for some water, accepted a canteen, and started across the cell.
"With respect, ma'am, I don't think you should do that," the sergeant said cautiously. "These suckers are incredibly violent."
"Jenkins is a private in the UNSC Marine Corps," McKay replied sternly, "and will be referred to as such, and your concern has been noted." Then, like a teacher dealing with a recalcitrant child, she held the canteen out where Jenkins could see it.
"Look,"
she said, sloshing the water back and forth. "Behave yourself, and I'll give you a drink." Jenkins tried to warn her, tried to say,
"No,"
but heard himself gabble instead. Thus encouraged, McKay unscrewed the canteen's lid, took 3 steps forward, and was just about to lean over when the combat form attacked. Jenkins felt his left arm break as the chain brought it up short, and fought to counter the other's attempt to grab the officer in a scissor lock. McKay stepped back just in time to evade the flailing legs. There was a clacking sound as the guard pumped a shell into the shotgun's receiver and prepared to fire. McKay shouted, "No!" and held up her hand. The non-com obeyed, but kept his weapon aimed at the combat form's head.
"Okay," McKay said, looking into the creature's eyes. "Have it your way. But like it or not, we're going to have a talk."
Silda had entered the cell by then and stood behind the lieutenant. The sergeant saw the major nod and backed into a corner with his weapon still held at the ready.
"My name is Silva," the major began, "and you already know Lieutenant McKay here. First, let me say both of us are extremely sorry about what happened to you. We understand how you feel, and we'll make sure that you receive the best medical care that the UNSC has to offer. But first, we have to fight our way off this ring. I think I know how we can do that, but it will take some time. We need to hold this butte until we're ready to make our move. That's where you come in. You know where we are now, and you know how the Flood move around. If you had my job, and you had to defend this base against the Flood, where would you focus your efforts?"
The Other used his right hand to grab his left, jerked hard, and exposed a shard of broken bone. Then, as if hoping to use that as a knife, the combat form lunged forward. The chains brought the creature up short. Jenkins felt indescribable pain, began to lose consciousness, but fought his way back. Silva looked at McKay and shrugged.
"Well, it was worth a try, but it looks like he's too far gone."
Jenkins half expected the Other to lunge forward again, but having shared in the human's pain, the alien consciousness chose that moment to retreat. The human surged into the gap, made hooting sounds, and used his good hand to point at Silva's right boot. The officer looked down at his boot, frowned, and was about to say something when McKay touched his arm.
"He isn't pointing at your boot, sir. He's pointing down, at the area under the butte."
Silva felt something cold trickle into his veins.
"Is that right, son? The Flood could be directly below us?"
Jenkins nodded emphatically, rolled his eyes, and made inarticulate gagging sounds. The major nodded and came to his feet.
Thank you, Private. We'll check the basement and be back to speak with you some more.
Jenkins didn't want to talk. He wanted to die, but nobody cared. The guards left, the door clanged shut, and the Marine was left with nothing but a broken arm and the alien inside his head. Somehow, without actually dying, he had been sentenced to hell. As if to confirm that conclusion, the other surged to the fore, yanked at the chains, and beat its feet on the floor. Food had been present. Food had left, and it remained hungry. The Master Chief spotted the next waypoint, put the hijacked Banshee down on a platform, and entered the complex via an unguarded hatch. He heard the battle before he actually saw it, made his way through the intervening tunnel, and peered through the next door. As had occurred before, the Covenant was busy taking it to the Flood, and vice versa, so he gave both groups some time to whittle each other down, left the security of the tunnel, and proceeded to tidy up. Then, eager to replenish his supplies, the Spartan made his ghoulish rounds, and soon was able to equip himself with an assault weapon, a shotgun, and some plasma grenades. Even though he didn't like to think about where it came from, it felt good to dump the Covenant ordnance he'd been saddled with and lay his hands on some true blue UNSC issue for a change. Pulse Generator 1 had been dealt with, and he was eager to disable Number 2, then move on to his final objective. He stepped into the beam, saw the flash of light, felt the floor shake, and was in the process of pulling away when the Flood attacked from every direction. There was no time to think and no time to fight. The only thing he could do was run. He turned and sprinted for the corridor he'd used to enter the chamber and took two powerful blows from a combat form. He bowled his way between two carrier forms and leapt out of the way as they detonated like grenades. New infection forms spewed from their deflating corpses. There was barely enough time to turn, hose the closest forms with 7.62mm, and toss a grenade at the group beyond. It went off with a loud wham, broke glass, and put three of the monstrosities down. He was out of ammo by then, knew he lacked the time necessary to reload, and made the switch to the shotgun instead. The gun blew huge holes through the oncoming mob. He charged through one of them and ran like hell. Then, with some pad to work with, the human turned to gun down the pursuers. The entire battle consumed no more than 2 minutes, but it left the chief shaken. Could Cortana detect the slight tremor in his hands as he reloaded both weapons? Hell, she had unrestricted access to all of his vital signs, so she knew more about what was going on with his body than he did. Still, if the AI was conscious of the way he felt, there was no sign of it in her words.
Pulse generator deactivated. Good work.
The chief nodded wordlessly and made his way back through the tunnel to the point where the Banshee waited.
The Pillar of Autumn is located 1,200 kilometers upspin, Cortana continued. Energy readings show her fusion reactors are still powered up. The systems on the Pillar of Autumn have fail-safes even I can't override without authorization from the captain. We'll have to find him, or his neural implants, to start the fusion core detonation.
One target remaining. Let's take care of the final pulse generator.
A nav indicator appeared on the non-comms HUD as he lifted off, took fire from a neighboring installation, and put the attack ship into a steep dive. The ground came up fast. He pulled out and guided the alien assault craft through a pass and into the canyon beyond. The nav indicator pointed toward the light that spilled out of a tunnel. The Banshee began to take ground fire, and the Spartan knew his piloting skills were about to be severely tested. A rocket flashed by as he pushed the Banshee down onto the deck, fired the aircraft's weapons, and cut power. Flying into the tunnel was bad enough, but flying into it at high speed verged on suicidal. Once inside the passageway, the challenge was to stay off the walls and make the tight right and left-hand turns without killing himself. A few seconds later, the Spartan saw double blast doors and flared in for a jarring landing. He hopped down, made his way over to the control panel, hit the switch, and heard a rumbling sound as the doors started to part. Then there was a bang as something exploded and the enormous panels came to a sudden stop. The resulting gap was too small for the Banshee, but sufficient for two carrier forms to scuttle through. The beasts scrambled toward him on short, stubby legs. The humpbacked bladders that formed their upper torsos pulsed and wriggled as the infection forms within struggled for release. The chief blew both monsters away with twin shotgun blasts and mopped up the rest of the infection forms with another shot. He paused and reloaded. There were bound to be more of the creatures on the far side of the doors. Resigned to a fight, he stepped through the crack and paused. There was no sound beyond the gentle roar of machinery, the drip, drip, drip of water off to his right, and the rasp of his own breathing. The threat indicator was clear, and there were no enemies in sight. But that didn't mean much, not where the Flood were concerned. They had a habit of coming out of nowhere. The cave, if that was the proper word for the huge cavern-like space, featured plenty of places to hide. Enormous pipes emerged from the walls and dived downward. Mysterious installations stood like islands on the platform around him, and there was no way to know what might lurk in the dark corners. Lights, mounted high above, provided what little illumination there was. The human stood on a broad platform that ran the full length of the open area. A deep chasm separated his platform from what appeared to be an identical structure on the other side of the canyon. One of two bridges that had once spanned the gorge was down, leaving only one over which he could pass, a made-to-order choke point for anyone who wanted to establish an ambush. There wasn't a hell of a lot of choice, so he marched down to the point where the remaining span was anchored and started across. He hadn't gone more than 30 paces before 50 or 60 infection forms emerged from hiding and danced out to block the way. The Spartan held his position, waited for the Flood forms to come a little closer, and tossed a fragmentation grenade into the center of the group. The cavern ate some of the sound, but the explosive device still managed to produce a bang, and the resulting shrapnel laid waste to all but a handful of the creatures. There were two survivors, though, both optimists, who continued to bounce forward in spite of the way in which the rest of the group had been annihilated. A single shotgun blast was sufficient to kill both of them. He slipped some additional shells into the gun's magazine tube, took a deep breath, and moved forward again. He made it about halfway to the other side before a mixed force of combat forms, carrier forms, and infection forms started to gather at the far end of the span. Another grenade inflicted casualties, but they charged him after that, and the Master Chief was forced to retreat, firing the assault weapon as he did so. It was nip and tuck for a few seconds as combat forms launched themselves 15 meters through the air. Carriers charged straight in, and the omnipresent infection forms swarmed through the gaps. Retreating, the Spartan had already reloaded 3 times before his back hit the wall, and the last combat form collapsed at his feet, started to rise, and took a blast in the head. Once again, it was time to reload both weapons, step out onto the gore-splattered bridge deck, and attempt another crossing. This one was successful, with only light opposition on the other side, and an opportunity to replenish his ammo. The next set of blast doors opened flawlessly, allowing the Spartan to enter a relatively short section of tunnel that led back to the surface. Determined to use stealth, if at all possible, he slipped out of the passageway, scrambled up over the snow embankment to his right, and ran into a group of 4 Flood. A grenade took care of 2, and the assault weapon finished the rest. A Banshee swooped in, burned a long line of dashes into the snow, and continued up the valley. The chief was surprised to get off so lightly, but given the darkness and all of the confusion, it was possible that the pilot had mistaken him for a combat form. A worthy target, to be sure, but not something to turn around for, particularly not when the valley was full of combat forms. He was careful to hug the face of the cliff and stay within the cover provided by the boulders and trees that lined the edge of the valley. The incessant thud of automatic weapons and the whine of plasma weapons testified to the intensity of a conflict raging off to his left. Then, just as he was starting to believe that he could slide by without firing a shot, he came up over a slight rise to see that the Covenant and Flood were engaged in hand-to-hand combat within the depression below. A grenade followed with bursts of fire from the MA-5B decimated both groups. Snow crunched as the human made his way down through the blood-stained snow, past the spot where a trio of greedy infection forms squabbled over a wounded elite, and up another rise to a stand of trees where a combat form and a carrier tried to jump him. Both of the floods staggered as bursts of 7.62-millimeter slugs cut them down, and they flopped onto the snow. Having broken through the perimeter of the battle, the Master Chief was able to follow the nav indicator into a second valley, where he came upon a group of dead Marines, loaded up on ammo, and tried to decide whether to stay with the scattergun or trade it in for a sniper's rifle or a rocket launcher. It would have been nice to have all three, but that many weapons would be unwieldy, not to mention damned heavy. In the end, he went with the rifle and shotgun, and hoped it was the right decision. The Spartan checked the Marines for dog tags, discovered that they had already been taken by someone else, and took the time required to drag the bodies into a nearby cave in the hope that the infection forms wouldn't find them. That seemed like a good place to stash the extra weapons, so that's what he did. Then, having followed the second valley to the point where it opened onto a third valley, he came across a now familiar scene. The Covenant were battling the Flood with everything they had, including shades, a brace of ghosts, and two extremely active wraiths, but the Flood had plenty of bodies to throw back at them and didn't hesitate to do so. What the Chief wanted was the Banshee that was parked at the head of the valley, but in order to get at the aircraft, it would be necessary to cut both groups down to size. He stayed right, slipped along the cliff face, made use of a thin screen of trees and boulders to hide his movements from those out toward the center of the valley. Finally, having passed behind a house-sized rock and found a vantage point that allowed him to look out on the area where the vast majority of the Covenant were congregated, the Spartan unlimbered the S2AM, selected the 10x setting for the scope, and began his bloody work. In this particular situation, he selected the softest targets first, starting with the grunts on the shades, followed by the outlying jackals, all in hope that he could inflict a lot of casualties before the elites took notice and sent the tank to get him. The problem was that the little world inside the scope was all-consuming, a fact that caused him to let down his guard. The first hint he had that a flood form had come up behind him was when it whacked the Spartan in the head. The blow would have killed anyone else, but the armor saved him, and the Chief rolled in the direction of the blow. The long-barreled S-2 wasn't well suited for close-in combat, but that's what he had in his hands. There was no time to aim as the flood form charged, only time to fire, and that's what he did. The slug caught the ex-elite in the chest. The combat form didn't even flinch as the bullet passed through its spongy center of mass. A tiny spurt of gray-green ichor trailed from the entry wound as the creature swung a vicious blow at the Master Chief. He ducked the attack and dropped the rifle. He dived, tucked into a roll, and came up with his sidearm in his hand. He emptied the clip into the beast. One round blew its left arm off, and the final round made a foot-wide exit wound in the Flood's back. He kicked in the creature's chest, crushing the infection form within. He collected the S2 and frowned. He studied the fallen Flood for a moment, and saw that the creature's insides were rapidly liquefying. The velocity of the S2's projectile had passed through the non-vital mass of the creature's chest and just kept going. Another nasty surprise, courtesy of the Flood. After a quick look around to make sure that there weren't any more surprises lurking in the vicinity, with his heart still beating like a trip hammer, the Chief went back to his grisly work. Three more Covenant warriors fell before a barrage of fireballs arced high into the air to land all around his position. One came so close that just the bleed off it was enough to push his shielding into the red and trigger the alarm. He pulled back, switched to the assault weapon long enough to ice a couple of overly ambitious grunts, and switched back to the S2 as he rounded the opposite side of the big boulder. He selected a spot where he could go to work on both the Covenant and the Flood, and settled in. He wanted to nail the elites now, and thanks to the powerful 14.5-millimeter armor-piercing rounds, he could drop most of them with a single shot. Combat forms were a different story, so he switched to the pistol. It was less accurate, but did the job. It wasn't long before more than a dozen bodies were laid out in the snow. But then the word was out. Soon the mortar tank moved into position to bombard his new position, and it was necessary to pull back. The Wraith was a problem, a serious problem, which meant there was only one thing the Spartan could do. Hike back to the weapons cache and trade the rifle for the launcher. It was a major pain in the ass, but he didn't have much choice, so he pulled out. It took a full half hour to make the round trip between the valley and the weapons cache, so he expected things to have calmed down a bit by the time he returned. That wasn't the case, however, which suggested that the flood had thrown even more forms into the battle. The chief followed his own footprints back to the hiding place next to the big boulder, put the launcher on his shoulder, and hit the zoom. The Wraith, which was busy hurling bombs down valley, seemed to leap forward. As if somehow aware of his presence, the tank spun on its axis and launched a bomb toward the rock. The Spartan forced himself to ignore the artificial comet, locked onto the target, and triggered the rocket. There was an impact and a loud crump, followed by smoke, but the Wraith continued to fire nonetheless. Now, with fireballs exploding all around him, the Master Chief had to take a deep breath, hold the tank at the center of his sight, and pull the trigger again. The tube jerked, the second missile ran straight and true, and hit with a loud crack! The Wraith opened like a red flower, burped pitch-black smoke, and nosed into a snowbank.
"Nice shot," Cortana said admiringly. "But watch the ghost."
It was good advice, because although the attack vehicle had held back up to that point, it came skittering into sight, opened up with its plasma weapons, and threatened to accomplish what the rest of the Covenant soldiers hadn't. But the chief had reloaded by then. The rocket tube was the right weapon for the job, and a single missile was sufficient to send the attack vehicle flipping end for end to finally wind up with its belly in the air and flames licking at the engine compartment. With that problem out of the way, the chief came to his feet, slapped a fresh load into the launcher, and made a beeline for the Banshee. He was halfway across, with nowhere to hide, when a pair of hunters emerged from a jumble of boulders. Now, grateful that he still had some rockets, he had no choice but to stop, drop to one knee, and take them on. The first shot was dead on, hit the alien in the chest, and blew the bastard apart. Another rocket flew over the second hunter's right shoulder and cut a tree in half. The big alien started to lumber across open ground, picking up speed and charging its arm-mounted cannon. It was a waste of ammo to pepper the front end of a hunter with 7.62-millimeter rounds, and slow though he was, the alien could still bring him down with a blast from his arm-mounted fuel rod cannon. So he put his sight onto a target so big he didn't need to zoom, and let fly. The hunter saw the missile coming, tried to deflect it with his shield, and failed. Seconds later, pieces of warm meat showered the area, melted holes in the snow, and continued to steam. The chief ran past without a second look, jumped onto the Banshee, and strafed the rest of the Covenant forces on his way down the valley. Judging from the way the nav indicator was oriented, the Spartan needed altitude, a lot of it, so he put the alien attack ship into a steep climb. Finally, when the red delta flipped over and started to point down, he knew he was high enough. He did a nose-over and caught his first glimpse of the waypoint below. The surrounding area was dark, and snow continued to fall, but the platform was nicely lit. He lowered the Banshee onto the pad and had just bailed out of the pilot seat when the sentinels attacked.
"This is the last one," Cortana said. "The monitor will do anything to stop us."
The chief blew three of the pesky machines out of the air, backed through the hatch, and let the door close on the rest.
"We're close," the AI commented. "The generator is up ahead."
The chief nodded, stepped out into a room, and felt a laser burn across the front of his armor. It seemed that the monitor had posted sentinels inside the complex as well. Not only that, but these machines had benefit of intermittent force fields, which were resistant to automatic weapons fire. Still, he had a couple of 102-millimeter surprises in store for the electromechanical enforcers, which he fired into the center of the hovering pack. Three sentinels were blown out of the air. A fourth did loops as it tried to rid itself of a plasma grenade, failed, and took another machine with it. The fifth and sixth succumbed to a hail of bullets as their shields recharged, while the seventh slammed into a wall, crashed to the floor, and was busy trying to lift off again when the chief stomped it to death. The way was clear at that point, and the Spartan was quick to take advantage of it. A few quick strides were sufficient to carry him into the central chamber, where he was free to approach the final pulse generator.
"Final target neutralized," Cortana said as the non-com stepped back a few moments later. "Let's get out of here."
"Let's find a ride and get to the captain," the chief agreed, as he prepared to leave.
"No, that'll take too long."
"Do you have a better idea?"
"There's a teleportation grid that runs around Halo. That's how the monitor moves about so quickly," the AI explained. "I learned how to tap into the grid when I was in the control center."
"So," the chief asked, somewhat annoyed, "why didn't you just teleport us to the pulse generators?"
"I can't. Unfortunately, each jump requires a rather consequential expenditure of energy, and I don't have access to Halo's power systems to reroute the energy we need."
She paused, then reluctantly continued.
"There may be another way, however."
The Spartan frowned and shook his head. "Something tells me I'm not going to like this."
"I'm pretty sure I can pull the energy we need from your suit without permanently damaging your shield system or the armor's power cells," Cortana continued. "Needless to say, I think we should only try this once."
"Agreed. Tap into the Covenant network and see if you can find him. If we've only got one shot at this, we should make it a good one." There was a pause as Cortana worked her magic with the intrusion and scan software. A moment later, she exclaimed,
"I've got a good lock on Captain Key's CNI transponder signal. He's alive, and the implants are intact. There's some interference from the cruiser's damaged reactor. I'll bring us in as close as I can."
"Do it," the Master Chief growled. "Let's get this over with." No sooner had the Spartan spoken than bands of golden light started to ripple down over his armor. The now familiar feeling of nausea returned, and the Master Chief seemed to vanish through the floor. Once he was gone, only a few motes of amber light remained to mark his passing. Then, after a few seconds, they too disappeared. Chapter 11 D-173-134-16, Spartan 117 Mission Clock, on board the Truth and Reconciliation. He wasn't here, wasn't there, wasn't anywhere insofar as the chief could tell from within the strange never-never land of Halo's teleportation net. He couldn't see or hear anything, save a sense of dizzying velocity. The Spartan felt his body stitched back together one molecule at a time. He saw snatches of what looked like the interior of a Covenant ship as bands of golden light strobed up and disappeared over his head. Something was wrong, and he was just starting to figure out what it was. The inside of the ship seemed to be upside down when he flipped head over heels and crashed to the deck. He'd materialized with his feet planted firmly on the corridor's ceiling.
"Oh," Cortana exclaimed, "I see the coordinate data needs to be..."
The chief came to his feet, slapped the general area where his implants were, and shook his head. The AI sounded contrite.
"Right. Sorry."
"Never mind that," the Spartan said. "Give me a sit rep." She patched back into the Covenant computing systems, a much easier task now that they were aboard one of the enemy's warships.
"The Covenant network is absolute chaos," she replied. "From what I've been able to piece together, the leadership ordered all ships to abandon Halo when they found the Flood, but they were too late. The Flood overwhelmed this cruiser and captured it."
"I assume," he said, "that's bad."
"The Covenant thinks so. They're terrified that the Flood will repair the ship and use it to escape from Halo. They sent a strike team to neutralize the Flood and prepare the ship for immediate departure."
The chief peered down the corridor. The bulkheads were violet, or was that lavender? Strange patterns marbled the material like the oily sheen of a beetle's carapace. Whatever it was, he didn't care for it, especially on a military vessel. But who knew? Maybe the Covenant thought olive drab was for wimps. He started forward, but quickly came up short, as a voice that verged on a groan came in over his implants.
"Chief, don't be a fool. Leave me,"
It was Keyes' voice. Keyes, Jacob, Captain, service number 01928199912, Juliet Kilo. He clung to the tether of his CNI carrier wave and heard familiar voices, an iron-hard, rasping male voice, a tart, warm female voice. He knew them. Was this another memory? He was struggling to dredge up new pieces of his past to delay the numbing advance of the alien presence in his mind. It was harder to maintain a grasp on who he was as the various pieces of his life, the things that made him who he was, were stripped away one at a time. Keyes, Jacob, Captain, service number 01928199912, Juliet Kilo. The voices, they were talking about him, the Master Chief, the AI Cortana. He felt a sense of mounting panic. They shouldn't be here. The other grew stronger and pressed forward, eager to learn more about these creatures that were so important to the struggling prisoner who clung so stubbornly to identity. Keyes, Jacob, Captain, service number 01928199912, Juliet Kilo.
Chief, Cortana, you shouldn't have come. Don't be a fool. Leave me. Get out of here. Run.
The presence descended, and he could feel its anticipation of victory. It wouldn't be long now.
Captain? Cortana inquired desperately. Captain! I've lost him!
Neither one of them said anything further. The pain in Key's voice had been clear. All they could do was drive deeper into the ship and hope to find him. The chief passed through a hatch, noticed that the right bulkhead was splattered with Covenant blood, and figured a battle had been fought there. That meant he could expect to run into the flood at any moment. As he continued down the passageway, his throat felt unusually dry. His heart beat a little faster, and his stomach muscles were tight. His suspicions were soon confirmed as he heard the sounds of battle, took a right, and saw that a firefight was underway at the far end of the corridor. He let the combatants go at it for a bit, before moving in to cut the survivors down. From there he took a left, followed by a right, and came to a hatch. It opened to reveal a black hole with jagged edges. Farther back, beyond the drop-off, another firefight was underway.
"Analyzing data," Cortana said. "This hole was caused by some sort of explosion. All I detect down there are pools of coolant. We should continue our search somewhere else."
The AI's advice made sense, so the Spartan turned to retrace his steps. Then, as he took the first left, all hell broke loose. Cortana said,
"Warning! Threat level increasing!"
And then, as if to prove her point, a mob of flood came straight at him. He fired, retreated, and fired again. Carrier forms exploded in a welter of shattered flesh, severed tentacles, and green slime. Combat forms rushed forward as if eager to die, danced under the impact of the 7.62-millimeter rounds, and flew apart. Infection forms skittered across the decks, leapt into the air, and shattered into flaps of flying flesh. But they were too many, far too many, for one person to handle. And even as the chief heard Cortana say something about the black hole, he accidentally backed into it, fell about 20 meters, and plunged feet first into a pond of green liquid. Not in the ship, but somewhere under it, on the surface below. The coolant was so cold that he could feel it through his armor. It was thick, too, which made it more difficult to move. The Master Chief felt his boots hit bottom, knew the weight of his armor would hold him in place, and marched up onto what had become a beach of sorts. The cavern was dark, lit mostly by the luminescent glow produced by the coolant itself, although streaks of plasma fire slashed back and forth up ahead, punctuated by the steady thud, thud, thud of an automatic weapon.
"Let's get out of here," Cortana said, "and find another way back aboard the ship."
He moved up toward the edge of the conflict and let the combatants hammer each other for a bit before lobbing a grenade into the mix, waiting for the body parts to fall and strafing what was left. Then, having moved forward, he was forced to fight his way through a series of narrow, body-strewn passageways as what seemed like an inexhaustible supply of flood forms came at him from every possible direction. Eventually, having made his way through grottos of coolant and past piles of corpses, Cortana said,
"We should head this way, toward the ship's gravity lift.
and the Spartan saw a nav pointer appear on his HUD. He followed the red arrow around a bend to a ledge above a coolant-filled basin. Even as he watched, a dozen carrier forms marched up out of the green lagoon to attack a group of hard-pressed Covenant soldiers. The Spartan knew there was no way in hell that he'd be able to force his way through that mess, turned, and made his way back down the trail. A sniper rifle, just one of hundreds of weapons scattered around the area, was half obscured by a headless combat form. The petty officer removed the rifle, checked to ensure that it was loaded, and returned to the overlook. Then, careful to make each shot count, he opened fire. The elites, jackals, and grunts went down fairly easily, but the flood forms, especially the carriers, were practically impossible to kill with this particular weapon. With few exceptions, the heavy rounds seemed to pass right through the lumpy-looking bastards without causing any harm whatsoever. When all of the 14.5mm ammo was gone, the chief went back for the shotgun, jumped into the green liquid, and waded up onto the shoreline. He heard an obscene sucking noise, saw an infection form trying to enter an elite's chest cavity, and blew both of them away. After that, there was more cleanup to do as some combat forms took a run at the human, and a flock of infection forms tried to roll him under. Repeated doses of shotgun fire turned out to be just what the doctor ordered. The area was soon littered with severed tentacles and scraps of wet flesh. A pitch-black passageway led him back to another pool, where he arrived just in time to see the flood overrun a shade and the elite who was seated at the controls. The Spartan began firing, already backpedaling, when the flood spotted him and hopped, waddled, and jumped forward. He fired, reloaded, and fired again, always retreating, always on the defensive, always hoping for a respite. This wasn't his kind of fight. Spartans were designed as offensive weapons, but ever since they'd landed on the ring, he'd been on the run. He had to find a way to take the offensive, and soon. There was no break in the endless wall of flood attackers. He fired until his weapons were empty, pried energy weapons out of dead fingers, and fired those until they were dry. Finally, more by virtue of stubbornness than anything else, and having reacquired human weapons from dead combat forms, the Master Chief found himself standing all alone, rifle raised, with no one to shoot at. He felt a powerful sense of elation. He was alive. It was a moment he couldn't take time to enjoy. Eager to reboard the cruiser and find Captain Keyes, he made his way back along the path he had been forced to surrender to the flood, past the shade, rounded a bend, and saw a couple dozen infection forms materialize out of the darkness ahead. A plasma grenade strobed the night, pulverized their bodies, and produced a satisfying boom! It was still echoing off the canyon walls as the human eased his way through a narrow passage and emerged at one end of a hotly contested pool. About 50 meters away, the Covenant and Flood surged back and forth, traded fire with each other, and appeared to be on the verge of hand-to-tentacle combat. Two well-thrown grenades cut the number of hostiles in half. The MA-5B took care of the rest.
"There's the gravity lift," Cortana said. "It's still operational. That's our way back in."
It sounded simple, but as the Master Chief looked up at the hill on which the lift was sighted, well-aimed plasma fire lashed down to scorch the rock at his right elbow.
It glowed as the human was forced to pull back, wait for a lull, and dash forward again. Looking ahead, he spotted the point where a group of hard-pressed Covenant were trying to bar a group of Flood from making their way up a path toward the top of the hill and the foot of the gravity lift. It was a last stand, and the Covenant knew it. They fought harder than he'd ever seen the aliens fight. He felt a moment of kinship with the Covenant soldiers. He stood and threw two grenades into the middle of the melee, waited for the twin explosions, and went in shooting. An elite sent plasma stuttering into the night sky as he fell over backward. A combat form swung a jackal's arm like a club, and a pair of infection forms rode a grunt down into the pool of coolant. It was a madness, a scene straight from hell, and the human had little choice but to kill everything that moved.
As the last bodies crumpled to the ground, the Spartan was free to follow the steadily rising path upward, turn to the right, and enter the lift's footprint.
He felt static electricity crackle around his armor and heard plasma shriek through the air as a distant covenant took exception to his plans. Then the chief was gone, pulled upward into the belly of the beast.
Keys? Keys. Jacob, yes. That was it. Wasn't it?
He couldn't remember. There was nothing left now but navigation protocols, defense plans, and a duty to keep them safe. A droning buzz filled his mind. He vaguely remembered hearing it before, but didn't know what it was. It pressed in, hungry. Metal rang under her boots as McKay jumped down off the last platform onto the huge metal grating. It shivered in response. The trip down from the mesa had taken more than 15 minutes. First, she had taken the still-functional lift down to the point where she and her troops had forced their way into the butte, back when the Covenant still occupied it, then transferred to the circular staircase, which, like the rifling on the inside of a gun barrel, wound its way down to the bottom of the shaft and the barrier under her feet.
"Good to see you, ma'am,"
a private said, as he materialized at her elbow.
"Sergeant Lister would like to speak with you."
McKay nodded, said, "Thanks," and made her way over to the far side of the grating, where the so-called entry team were gathered into a tight little group next to an assemblage of equipment that had been lowered from above. A portable worklight glowed at the very center of the assemblage and threw huge shadows up onto the walls around them. Bodies parted as McKay approached, and Lister, who was down on his hands and knees, jumped to his feet.
"Ten hut!"
Everyone came to attention. McKay noticed the way that the long hours and constant stress had pared what little bit of extra flesh there was off the noncom's face, leaving it gaunt and haggard.
"As you were, how does it look? Any contact?"
"No, ma'am," Lister responded. "Not yet. But take a look at this."
A Navy tech directed a handheld spotlight down through the grating, and the officer knelt to get a better look. The stairs, which had ended on the far side of the platform, appeared to pick up again just below the grating and circled into the darkness below.
"Look at the metal," Lister prompted, "and look what's piled up on the stairs below."
McKay looked, saw that the thick metal crosspieces had been twisted out of shape, and saw a large pile of weapons below. No human ordnance, as far as she could tell, just Covenant, which was to say plasma weapons. With no cutting torches to call upon, not yet anyway, it looked as though the flood had depleted at least 100 energy pistols and rifles in a futile attempt to cut their way through the grating. Given some more time, say another day or two, they might have succeeded.
"You've got to give the bastards credit," McKay said grimly. "They never give up."
"Well, neither do we. Let's cut this sucker open, get down, and lock the back door."
Lister said,
"Ma'am, yes, ma'am."
But there were none of the usual gung-ho responses from the others who stood around him. It was dark down there, and nightmares lay in wait.
Once inside the Pillar of Autumn, Zamami and Yayap found conditions to be both better and worse than they had expected. Consistent with the grunt's predictions, the officer in charge, an overworked elite named Antomi, had been extremely glad to see them, and wasted little time placing Zamami in charge of 20 jackals, with Yayap as senior NCO.
That, plus the fact that the security detachment had a reasonable amount of supplies, including methane, meant that basic physical needs had been met. That was the good news.
The bad news was that Zamami, now known as Huki Umami, lived in constant fear that an elite who knew either him or the recently deceased commando he had decided to impersonate would come along and reveal his true identity, or that the prophets would somehow pluck the information out of thin air, as they were rumored to be able to do.
These fears caused the officer to lay low, stay out of sight, and delegate most of his leadership responsibilities to Yayap. This would have been annoying but acceptable where a contingent of grunts was concerned, but was made a great deal more difficult by the fact that the jackals saw themselves as being superior to the gas suckers, and were anything but pleased when they found themselves reporting to Yayap. Then, as if to add to the grunt's woes, the flood had located the Pillar of Autumn, and while they were unable to infiltrate the vessel via any of the maintenance ways that ran back and forth just below the Ringworld surface, they had become adept at entering the vessel through rents in its severely damaged hull,
the airlocks where lifeboats had once been docked, and on one memorable occasion, via one of the Covenant's own patrols, which had been ambushed, turned into combat forms, and sent back into the ship. The ruse had been detected, but only after some of the contaminated soldiers were inside the vessel. A few of them were still at large, somewhere within the human vessel. As the Grunt and his group of surly jackals stood guard in the Autumn shuttle bay, a dropship loaded with supplies circled over the downed ship, asked for and received the necessary clearances, and swooped in for a landing. Yayup eyed his recalcitrant troops, saw that three of them had drifted away from their pre-assigned positions, and used his radio to herd them back.
"Jack, Buck, and Yegg, we have a shuttle coming in. Focus on the dropship, not the area outside."
The jackals were too smart to say anything over the radio, but the Grunt knew they were grumbling among themselves as they returned to their various stations and the ship settled onto the blast-scarred deck.
"Watch the personnel slots,"
Yayup cautioned his troops, referring to the small compartments that lined the outside surfaces of the shuttle's twin hulls.
"They could be packed with flood."
In spite of the resentment he felt, Bach touched a switch and opened all of the slots for inspection, a new security procedure instituted 3 days before. The compartments were empty. The jackals sniggered, and there was nothing Yayup could do but suffer through the indignity of it.
With that formality out of the way, a crew of grunts moved in to unload supplies from the cargo compartments that lined the inside surface of the dropship's hulls, and towed the heavily loaded antigrav pallets out onto the deck. Then, with the unloading process complete, the shuttle rose on its grav field, turned toward the hatch, and passed out into bright sunlight. The cargo crew checked the label on each cargo container to see where it was supposed to go, gabbled at one another, and were about to tow the pallets away when Yayup intervened.
"Stop! I want you to open those cargo mods one at a time. Make sure they contain what they're supposed to."
If the previous order had been unpopular, this one met with out-and-out rebellion, as Bach decided to take Yayup on.
"You're no elite. We're under orders to deliver this stuff now. If we're late, they'll take our heads."
He paused and clicked his beak meaningfully.
"And our kin will take yours, gas sucker."
The jackals, all of whom were enjoying the interchange to the maximum, looked at each other and grinned.
Zamami should have been there, should have been giving the orders, and Yayup cursed the officer from the bottom of his heart.
"No,"
he replied stubbornly.
"Nothing leaves here until it has been checked. That's the new process. The elites were the ones who came up with it, not me. So open them up, and we'll get you and your crew out of here."
The other alien grumbled, but knew the rule-happy elites would back Yayup, and turned to his crew.
"All right, you heard Field Master Gas Sucker. Let's get this over with."
Yayup sighed, ordered his jackals to form a giant U with the open end toward the cargo containers, and took his own place in the line. What ensued was boring, to say the least, as each cargo module was opened, closed, and towed out of the way. Finally, with only three containers to go, Bach undogged a hatch, pulled the door open, and disappeared under an avalanche of infection forms. One of the attacking pods grabbed onto the jackal's head, wrapped its tentacles around the creature's skull, drove a penetrator down through his throat, and had already tapped into the soldier's spine by the time Yayup yelled,
"Fire!"
and the rest of the jackals opened up. Nothing could live where the 20 plasma beams converged, and most of the infection forms were dead within 2 or 3 heartbeats. But Yayup thought he detected motion behind the mist created by the exploding pus pods and lobbed a plasma grenade into the cargo module. There was a flash of green-yellow light as the device went off, followed by a resonant boom as it detonated. The cargo container shook like a thing possessed, and chunks of raw meat flew out to spray the deck with gore. It was clear that 3... or maybe even 4 combat forms had been hiding in the cargo compartment, hoping to enter the ship. Now, as the last of the infection forms popped, a momentary silence settled over the shuttle bay. Bach's corpse smoldered on the deck.
"That was close,"
the jackal named Jack said.
"Those stupid gassers damned near got us killed. Good thing our fire leader kept them in line."
The soldiers to either side of the former critic nodded solemnly. Yayup,
who was close enough to hear the comment, wasn't sure whether to be angry or pleased. Somehow, for better or for worse, he'd been elevated to the position of honorary jackal. A full company of heavily armed Marines waited as torches cut through the metal grating, sparks fell into the Stygian blackness below, and each man or woman considered what awaited them. Would they survive, or leave their bones in the bottom of the hole? There was no way to know. Meanwhile, 30 meters away, two officers stood by themselves. McKay had borne far more than her fair share of the burden ever since the drop. Silva was aware of that, and regretted it. Part of the problem stemmed from the fact that she was his XO, an extremely demanding position that could burn even the most capable officer out. But the truth was, McKay was a better leader than her peers, as evidenced by the fact that the Helljumpers would follow her anywhere, even into a pit that might be filled with life-devouring monstrosities. But everyone had their limits, even an officer like McKay, and the Major knew she was close to reaching them. He could see it in the grim contours of her once rounded face, the empty staring eyes, and the set of her mouth. The problem wasn't one of strength. She was the toughest, most hardcore Marine he knew, but one of hope. Now, as he prepared to send her below, Silva knew she needed something real to fight for, something more than patriotism, something that would allow her to get at least some of the Marines to safety. That, plus the possibility that something could happen to him, lay behind the briefing that ensued. "So," Silva began, "go down, get the lay of the land, and see if you can slam the door on those bastards. 48 hours of flood-free operation would be ideal, but 24 would be sufficient, because we'll be out of here by then." McKay had been looking over Silva's shoulder, but the last sentence brought her eyes back to his. Silva saw the movement and knew he had connected. "Out of here, sir? Where would we go?" "Home," Silva said confidently. "To brass bands, medals, and promotions all around. Then, with the credibility earned here, we'll have the opportunity to create an army of Helljumpers and push the Covenant back to whatever hole they evolved from."
"And the Flood?" McKay asked, her eyes searching his face. "What about them?"
"They're going to die," Silva replied. "The AIs managed to link up a few hours ago. It turns out that the Chief is alive. Cortana is with him, and they're trying to rescue Keyes. Once they have him, they're going to rig the Autumn to blow. The explosion will destroy Halo and everything on it. I'm not a fan of the Spartan program, you know that, but I gotta give the bastard credit. He's one hell of a soldier."
"It sounds good," McKay said cautiously. "But how do we get off before the ring blows?"
"Ah," Silva replied. "That's where my idea comes in. While you're down cleaning out the sewers, I'll be up top, making the preparations necessary to take the Truth and Reconciliation away from the Covenant. She's space-worthy now, and Cortana can fly her. Or, if all else fails, we'll let Wellesley take a crack at it. It'll be a stretch, but he might be able to pull it off." Imagine, arriving back on Earth in a Covenant cruiser packed with Covey technology and loaded with data on Halo. The response will be incredible. The human race needs a victory right now, and we'll give them a big one. It was then, as McKay looked into the other officer's half-lit face, that she realized the extent to which raw ambition motivated her superior's actions, and knew that even if his wildest dreams were to come true, she wouldn't want any part of the glory that Silva sought. Just getting some Marines home alive, that would be reward enough for her. An old soldier's adage flashed across her mind: never share a foxhole with a hero. Glory and promotion were fine, but right now she'd settle for survival, plain and simple. First, there was a loud clang, followed by the birth of 6 blue-white suns, which illuminated the inside surface of the shaft as they fell to the filth-encrusted floor below. Then, the invaders dropped, not one at a time down the stairs as the infection forms might have assumed, but 6 all at once dangling on ropes. They landed within seconds of each other, knelt with weapons at the ready, and faced outward. Each Helljumper wore a helmet equipped with 2 lights and a camera. With simple back-and-forth movements of their heads, the soldiers created overlapping scans of the walls, which were transmitted up to the grating above, and from there to the mesa. McKay stood on the grating, eyed the raw footage on a portable monitor, and saw that four large arches penetrated the perimeter of the shaft and would need to be sealed in order to prevent access to the circular stairway. There was no sign of the flood.
"Okay," the officer said. "We have four holes to seal. I want those plugs at the bottom of the shaft 30 from now. I'm going down."
Even as McKay spoke and dropped into the hole which had been cut into the center of the grate, Wellesley was calculating the exact dimensions of each arch so that Navy techs could fabricate metal plugs that could be lowered to the bottom of the shaft, manhandled into position, and welded into place. Within a matter of minutes, computer-generated outlines were lasered onto metal plates, torches were lit, and the cutting began. McKay felt her boots touch solid ground and took her first look around. Now, finally able to see the surroundings with her own eyes, the company commander realized that a bas-relief mural circled the lower part of the shaft. She wanted to go look at it, to run her fingers across the grime-caked images recorded there, but knew she couldn't, not without compromising the defensive ring and placing herself in jeopardy.
"Contact!" one of the Marines said urgently. "I saw something move!"
"Hold your fire," McKay said cautiously, her voice echoing off the walls. "Conserve ammo until we have clear targets."
As soon as she'd given the hold fire order, the flood gushed out into the shaft. McKay screamed,
"Now, pull!"
And seven well-anchored winches jerked the entire team into the air and out of reach. The Marines fired as they ascended. One helljumper screamed curses at the combat form who was leading the charge. The loudmouthed Marine dropped his clip, loaded a fresh one into his rifle, and shouldered the weapon to resume fire. The combat form he'd been shooting leapt 15 meters into the air, wrapped his legs around the Marine's waist,